Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page. You can check out where all 1517 speakers are speaking. So it's not just, you know, we do a couple conferences, but we also have a speakers network that sends people like Chad and sometimes myself and guys like Eric Sorensen and Scott Keith and Dan Van Voorhis. We go around, do some speaking. And if you want to figure out if we're near you, you can go and go to the events page. But while you're at the events page, make sure you scroll until you hit that regional event in Northwest Arkansas. That's our event. That's Northwest Arkansas's regional Here We Still Stand conference. It's the fourth year we're doing it. It's sold out every year. You can get tickets right now. I recommend that you do. It is the first weekend in May. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. It's going to be a good time. It's a good place. Come to the Ozarks in the spring. There's a link in the show notes as well if you just want to get, you know, fast track over to the registration page and get those tickets. Come hang out with us. It's going to be a good time. Chad, we are starting a new book today. This is kind of an interesting section of the Bible where you get like this Esther Job back to back, where you get these two books that are just different. Jonah kind of falls in that category as well. But, you know, this is one of those books where it starts and you definitely don't know when we're talking about. Like, I mean, maybe you have some ideas. Every time I read Job, I'm like, when is this happening?
Oh, I've got the definitive answer. Yeah. All the commentaries, all the scholars will be coming to this episode, in fact, to find out the answer.
Yeah.
No. I mean, it is one of the weird things about Job. It's sort of it's definitely set. The narrative is set in a patriarchal period. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll talk about how we know that. But so in that way, it's kind of a cool bookend to Esther, because Esther is like way late. You know, we're in the Persian period. It's even after the Babylonians. I mean, this is like the very end. So Esther's on the one end of the spectrum. And then you got Job, though. I mean, he's like, you could see like Abraham walking up, checking on Job. I mean, it's kind of that whole flavor to the narrative. He's out offering sacrifices for his kids, and you know, there's no mention in the entire book of anything related to like the Exodus,
right?
Nothing like that. So all the things that we would expect from an Old Testament book aren't there,
even just like people that we know, right? This would help you sort of situate it. But you're like, there's no characters in this book that you're like, ah, there he is. Like, oh, so this prophet shows up or something.
Right, right. Yeah, so, you know, and you could find all kinds of ideas out there. I mean, even among conservative scholars as to when it was written. But whenever it was actually, like, put pen to scroll, the story itself is set way before any Israel existed or anything like that, because just the tone of it, the characters in it, what Job does, all of that stuff is very patriarchal, very kind of, you know, pre-Jacob, I guess you would say, or at least pre-Joseph kind of stuff going on. So it's a Genesis kind of book, in other words.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we'll get to the meat of the story itself in a minute. Just kind of a reminder. I'm sure everyone is, you know, somewhat familiar with the book, at least the story itself. But it is different because, you know, you start out with you think it's going to be another prose narrative,
right?
Because that's what starts. You know, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Okay, this is going to be a story. So you get the story, and you get a couple of chapters of that. It's just prose, you know, maybe a couple little poetry verses thrown in there, like, you know, the Lord gave, the Lord's taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. But you go from that in chapter 3 to poetry. And for a long time, you had this whole series of poetic speeches back and forth. And then you get to the very end, and in the last chapter, not at the beginning of the chapter, I think at the 7th verse, Job 42, verse 7, you slip back into prose again, slip back into narrative. So you're starting out with a story, basically, about this guy named Job. We'll hear what he's like, his qualities. and his family and his possessions. And then there's a change of scene, of course, to this heavenly throne room where you're going to have this dialogue back and forth between God and Satan. But anyway, that's the structure of the book. Couple of chapters of narrative prose, bunch of chapters of this dialogue poetry between Job, his three friends, some dude who jumps in, whatever he's been introduced to, named Elihu, who then disappears totally from the scene, and then God's speeches, and then the narrative again. So that's kind of the structure.
Yeah, it's a strange book in that way, right? Like where you're like, it's a story, but it's also there's a lot of poetry in this book. A
lot of poetry, yeah, yeah, and very. I mean, I know that we're not looking at all intricacies of the Hebrew, but it's like very. Job is, for those people who read Hebrew, Job is infamous for the difficulty of the Hebrew. So it's even, you know, it's unique. It's not just poetry, but it's very, very high level, difficult Hebrew poetry. It's not like you're reading, you know, one of Jeremiah's laments or you're even Isaiah with this elevated poetry. This is on a whole different level.
Yeah, or the Psalms.
So that sets it apart too. Yeah, or the Psalms, right. Yeah, I mean, I can open up the Psalms in Hebrew and I can read them pretty easily without looking up a lot of words. But open up Job and it's a whole different picture. I feel like I'm elementary again. Just looking at the Hebrew there. So, and it, another real striking feature about the book is the character of Job, because it's like you start out, Job has all these tremendous losses and he comes across as like this, you know, this stalwart champion of acceptance of suffering. Well, you know, the Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Or as he says to his wife, you know, are we supposed to just accept good from the Lord and not evil, or not, however you want to translate that, bad stuff? And then you're like, wow, man, this guy's, he's unique. Nobody just accepts suffering like that. And then you turn the page to chapter 3 and whoa, we got a different Job here. He's cursing the day of his birth.
Yeah.
And then he's lambasting God and he's, you know, wanting his day in court with God. So I love that about Job, because you see that there's different ways of dealing with suffering. There may be times in our lives where we're like, man, you know, that what happened was horrific. But blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. And that's fine. But there's plenty of other times where we're crying out in lament. Why? How long? Where are you, God? All those things that Job does on steroids. I mean, he's really going hard against what he considers to be this injustice that's been done to him. Yeah, so you got different sides of Job.
Yeah, there's it's one of those things where, you know, every person's sort of breaking point is different, and Job's breaking point is further down the road than most, I would say. He can endure a lot, it would seem. Yeah. But what you discover, and you're going to see this sort of in the sort of Satan God arrangement here, is that this is kind of what the devil's out to do, is like figure out which straw, how many straws can this camel's back take? And we're going to figure out where exactly the last one is. Job's back can take a lot of straw. But
yeah.
The kind of encouraging thing about Job is that, I mean, if you just wanted a hero story and he can shoulder an infinite amount of straw, then that's a nice story, but also nothing like us. However, Job's back can't take an infinite amount of straw. It could take a lot. It could probably take, it would seem more than me, probably more than you, Chad, but there is a point where that's that's now become too much.
Yeah, you know, one thing I've noticed too in my own life and in the lives of other people is that, especially believers, I have seen plenty of instances where there's like this initial, I don't know how to describe it. There's an initial kind of Job-like moment where your trust in God is strong despite the tremendous loss you've just suffered. But then there's tomorrow. And then there's the next week, and then there's the next month. And so that initial Job, like the Lord's taken, the Lord is Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, that can begin to fade as more and more of what maybe initially seemed surreal begins to just kind of seep into your bones as a horrific reality that now you have to live with.
Yeah.
So I think that you see that reflected not in Job, only in Job's life, but in our lives as well, because the longer we bear up under sufferings, the more the questions arise and we're like, the hell is going on here? You know? So you morph into, I think, more of a questioning, lamenting stance the longer the reality of the suffering is imposed upon you.
Well, it's sort of if you're trying to, you might be able to shoulder something pretty heavy. So you're like, all right, here's your big bundle of straw, and you're like, I can lift that. And mm-hmm. The question though becomes like, can you keep lifting it tomorrow and the next day and the next, like,
yeah.
How long can you carry it? Right. So maybe it doesn't even after all the suffering is totaled up and placed on you, maybe you can walk a day or 2 days or 3 days, but like, can you, how long without it being removed can you endure?
Yeah.
That's what part of it is. Part of it's just the devil goes on the war of attrition with Job. Like, how long though, without relief, are you going to be able to endure this suffering?
Yeah. Well, that's why one of the most common questions in the Psalms, and I don't know about Job, I haven't checked, but in Psalms, how long?
Yeah.
You know, this isn't just a day or a week. I mean, this has been going on a while. So how long, oh Lord, is this going to be happening? So that's part of, I think, what's happening in Job's life. Yeah. So I don't know if there's much more to be said, just to come out by way of introduction. We'll have, you know, we'll flesh out more of these details as we get into the story itself. But that's kind of basically it. You started with the prose, you end with prose. In between, well, toward the end of chapter two, you're introduced to these three friends of Job. And then most of the time in their conversations, Job introduces it and they respond. And Job introduces it and they respond. And then toward the very end, it's like they just give up. And Job has like these three speeches where they don't say anything. And then Elihu appears in the scene. He speaks. Nobody even responds to him, even God. And then God responds, and then we have the wrap up. So that's kind of the big picture. And we'll get to the details as we work our way through it. So verse one tells us almost everything that we need to know about the character of Job. So and this tells us his character, where he lives, but also the fact that this is going to be wisdom literature. So the very adjectives, the phrases that are used to describe Job introduces us to the genre of wisdom literature. I'll talk about more of that in just a second. So verse one, there was a man in the land of Uz, U-Z, whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So one of the commentators I was reading this morning, what's this guy's name? David Kleins, had a great point about this. You know, people debate, where's this land of Uz at? You know, where's this located? And his comment was, it's more important that we know where it's not than we know where it is. And his point was that it's not Israel.
Right.
So we're outside of Israel. That's the main point here. So wherever the land of Uz is, it's not Israel. So we're looking at something which is, we're looking at literature, we're looking at a story that is not Israelite in nature. Now, it's got plenty of Israelite theology baked into it. But this guy, so if we're looking at a patriarchal kind of era, stage of history, this is pre-Israel, has nothing to do specifically with the elect people of God, the Israelites. So in that way, it becomes universalizing. So it's not just the Israelite piece of literature. Now, Uz is Lamentations, I believe it's Lamentations chapter 4. Yeah, 421 puts it in parallel with Edom. Edom, of course, is the country named after Esau, so south of Israel. So there's possibility that Uz was located there. Some of the names of the characters seem to be Edomite related. So maybe, you know, Maybe it, that's where it was located, but its location is not what's important. Where it's not is what is important. So Job, he's described with language that could be plucked right from the text of Proverbs, and that's important. So he's blameless. He's upright. He fears God, and he turns away from evil. Now you can find all of the, of course, all of those scattered throughout the scriptures, but they are concentrated in wisdom literature. Now that's important because number one, it tells you that he is characterized, he's a characteristic wise man with all that implies. It means he, you know, he cares about justice. He cares about righteousness. He cares about fearing God. He cares about doing all the things that are typical of a wise person. But it also means that when we put Job, the book, into the genre of wisdom literature, we're we immediately have kind of a jarring contrast that's set up. Not contradiction, but contrast. Because what you have a lot in the book of Proverbs is basically this idea that if you lead this kind of life, righteous, wise, fearing God, then the result will be something positive in your life. I mean, a lot of the Proverbs are like that. Now that can, that kind of if-then formula, if you are righteous, then this good thing will result. Even though it's true, it's a generalization. And generalizations, of course, have to leave room for exceptions. And so Job enters the picture as a huge literary exception saying, yeah, well, it doesn't always work out that way, does it?
Well, well, with, Job, so, with Job, initially you're like, okay, so he's doing the things, man. So he's blameless and he's upright. He's fearing God. He's turning away from evil. And look at all the stuff he has. This is the way you want to do it. I mean, you live this way.
Formula right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Living right and you're living your best life right now. But then you discover that also, if you live this way, there also might be like a bet made between the devil and God regarding your piety. And this mm-hmm. is not something anyone wants.
No, no. Yeah, that formula kind of piety leads to prosperity. That's it. That's the impression that you get when you're first, I mean, look at this guy. Well, maybe if I'm blameless, upright, fear God, and turn away from evil, I too can have all these kids and sheep and camels and oxen and everything else, you know? So yeah, I mean, that's the initial impression that you get. And then you switch after a few verses to listening to what God and Satan are talking about. But I think that's it. It's important right away to get to understand that Job is being held up. Even God will say in a little bit, nobody else is like him.
Yeah.
And none other are like him. So the impression we're given of Job is kind of in the superlatives, right? I mean, this guy is it. Blameless, upright, fearing God, torn away from evil. He's not doing this hypocritically. This is who he is, all right? So, and then he has, after his character is described, we hear more about his family as well as his possessions. So, he had seven sons and three daughters. Now, with apologies to all the ladies out there in the Near East, having more sons and daughters was considered to be good. So, whether that's true or not, that's just what they thought.
Hey, he's got a lot of land to work.
That's right. It's all these boys out there with plows. You know, there's this great line in Ruth 4:15, where it says that Ruth was better than seven sons. Which, you know, what a great compliment for Ruth. But the comparison there is like, well, seven sons must be pretty good then if Ruth is better than seven sons. So of course, it's also an ideal number, seven, obviously. And then you have seven sons and then you have three daughters. Well, you put those two together, of course, and you have 10, which is another, this great biblical number of completeness. So notice also what happens here. So we have seven sons, but he also possessed 7,000 sheep. And then he has three daughters, and he also has 3,000 camels. So the kind of numerical symbolism continues into outside his family and into his possessions. He's got not just the sheep and camels. He's got 500 yoke of oxen. He's got 500 female donkeys, which if the commentators are right, I mean, I'm not a donkey guy. I've never had male donkeys or female donkeys. But according to the commentators, female donkeys are better. like produce milk. They're supposedly easier to ride. I don't know. I was raised
less
horses,
stubborn,
not donkeys. So yeah, maybe less stubborn. Yeah. So I was a horse guy growing up, not a donkey guy. So any donkey experts out there can correct me, but that's what I read anyway. So this guy, man, this guy's rich. He's got a big family, 10 kids total. He's got thousands of livestock, all the sheep, all the camels, all the oxen, all the female donkeys. Well, if you have that many animals, what else? I don't care if you have 20 or 30 sons, you're going to have a lot of people working for you. So he also has, we're told, very many servants. In fact, Job had so much that we read that he was the greatest of all the, well, ESV translates this as sons of the East. It is literally the sons of the, I mean, it turns to people of the East. It's literally sons of the East. So famous and wealthy and pious and seems to have, you know, everything that anybody would want. So that's just the opening three verses. And we hear more now about one aspect of the way in which his character showed through. So verse 4 says, his sons used to go and they would have a feast in the house of each one on his day. We're not told what this exactly refers to, but I'm guessing a birthday, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, his day, whatever it is. It kind of makes sense. Logically makes sense. So they have a party, you know, it was his birthday. So son one, everybody gathers at his place and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. Kind of an ideal situation described here. All the families together, they're having a feast. And the feast would go on for, this isn't like Sunday dinner. This is a several day feast. So when the days of the feast had run their course, then Job would send and consecrate them. And then he would get up early in the morning. And he would offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Because Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And this is what Job did continually. Now that tells us this is a huge indicator of the fact that we're looking at kind of a patriarchal period. Because this is exactly the kind of thing that Abraham would have done, or Isaac, or Jacob, or whoever. I mean, they served... The pater familias, the head of the family, he served as the priest. He's the one who's offering sacrifices. He's engaged not just in being a dad, not just being a husband, but he's also the priest of the family. So one little tidbit here that's kind of, you may notice this in your Bibles if you look, but it says that Job thought, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Now, Hebrew does something kind of strange sometimes. So if there's a statement that's considered to be, maybe blasphemous, or it just not looking good toward God, then in the actual Hebrew text, they'll switch the word to a euphemism. So if you're reading along in Hebrew,
they'll switch it to like almost the opposite, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it may be that my children have sinned and blessed God in their hearts. That's what the Hebrew text reads.
Yeah.
But it's a euphemism, and we have this. This isn't just isolated to Job. There's other places where this happens too. So, in the actual Hebrew text, they've written "blessed" with the understanding that when you read that, you're gonna be, "Oh, I see. That's a euphemism for the opposite." So that's why it's translated as "cursed" in most English translations. So Job is, I don't know. My impression of him, he's like hyper vigilant. I mean, this guy, he's even worried about his kids thinking blasphemous thoughts in their hearts while they have this birthday feast. And so he's going to get them all together. He's going to have this little ritual of consecration, whatever it might be. And then he's going to offer burnt offerings, sacrifices, so that just in case they did something wrong, they're covered.
Yeah, this is kind of funny to have this guy. I mean, it says something about like sort of the father that Job is, but just in case. These precautionary sacrifices, you know, like, well, there's a big party going on and they were all there and, you know, chances are somebody sinned somewhere. better take care of this. I don't have a specific sin in mind. I don't have any I didn't hear anything, but I'm just going to go ahead and do this.
You never know. A bunch of kids get together eating and drinking. Mm. No telling what's going on in their hearts. So we're gonna cover them. Now, of course, the impact of this is just to paint a fuller portrait of Job, to make sure that we, right away, as we enter this story, Job is elevated to almost kind of a superhuman status. I mean, I've never met a guy like this who has all this stuff. He's so incredibly pious, taking care of his family. You know, interestingly, I had not noticed this until this morning. You know, the one thing that's not mentioned in the first five verses that Job has, that you might assume would be there?
I think it's his wife. And
that would be it. Yeah. Interesting omission.
Not part of the blessing.
Not part of the blessing. Now, for those of you who know the story, you'll probably understand why. Because her portrayal there is not quite ambiguous as to her relation to Job, because as we'll see, at one point she's going to say, you know, why are you holding fast to your integrity, Job? Curse God and die.
Yeah, I mean,
so maybe that's the reason that she's not held up as a blessing.
Yeah, what you're going to find is that I think the reason she's omitted here is because all of these things are things that when the devil wants to torment Job, he takes away. When the devil also wants to torment Job, he leaves his wife. So that tells you something about, maybe, I don't know if there's a little demon conference, and they said, all right, and now for the final stroke, we take his wife. And the devil's like, no. Like, we're trying to torment this guy. We leave her. That's not good. Probably Chad and I are going to develop like a Bible study curriculum. Maybe we'll do like, you know, the goal in life is to be the kind of spouse that if the devil's trying to torment the other spouse, that you end up dead. It's the goal.
We'll get to work on that right away.
Yeah. If the devil would leave you around when he's trying to torment your spouse, I don't know if you're doing it right.
Probably not a good indication. All right, so everybody by now, just five verses in, should have in their minds a pretty good picture of the kind of guy that Job is. All right. Now we're going to switch. We spent some time kind of checking out his life, his family, his character, his possessions, his priesthood, if you will, all that kind of stuff. Now we're going to totally change directions, verse 6. And this is the first of I think, three or four times when we're going to hear the same phrase. Now there was a day when. So verse 6 introduces us to that. Verse 13 is also going to say, now there was a day when, and that's when he's going to lose all his stuff. And then chapter 2, verse 1 starts out, again, there was a day when. So that phrase helpfully kind of delineates these different parts of the narrative as we work our way through it. So we're going to switch now from earth to heaven, and we're going to see what happens in this heavenly council type of room, where you got all these B'nai HaElohim, which is translated usually the sons of God, are going to show up, and then Satan, or more specifically, the Satan, is among them. So let me just read verses 6 through 12, and we'll get the full thing at once. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So we'll stop there. So again, switch from the earthly scene to the heavenly scene. This is the heavenly courtroom, heavenly council that we hear about in a lot of other places in the scriptures, where you have God, and then you have around him these angelic courtiers, or whatever you want to refer to them as. Here, they're called the B'nai HaElohim. Same phrase that's used other places in scripture, like Genesis chapter 6, and in other places where these, what we ordinarily refer to as angels, created beings, are called the sons of God. And they're called sons of God for the same reason, for instance, that these prophetic bands, like in Elijah and Elisha's day, were called the sons of the prophets, because they are connected to this figure that they are kind of serving or learning from, whatever it might be. So don't, in other words, don't interpret these sons of God as if they are the same as Jesus, the Son of God. These are created beings who are celestial, and they're the servants of the Lord. They're just called different things in the scriptures. I mean, sometimes they're called servants, sometimes they're called angels, sometimes they're called the heavenly host, kind of heavenly army. Here they're called the sons of God. So they come to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. I don't want to go too much in the weeds on this. Literally, it is Hasatan, so the Satan. And this is the typical way in the Old Testament that he's introduced, where it's not a name per se, but a title.
Right.
But
yeah.
What you see,
I think that is kind of important. The Satan. So you could just think of this as the devil. There you go. This, you know, Satan shows up. But this is like literally, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, Hebrew guy, but like this is literally like the accuser shows up, right? So like, or the adversary shows up.
Right, right.
So it's, which I like, because it's a title, but it's also a description of who is this person? Well, he's the one that like
what
accused,
he does.
He accuses people. He's is he going to be an adversary to Job? I think so. This is exactly right. And so it's informative for how we think about the devil, as opposed to just sort of this dark force that just the opposite of God, just the sort of yin and yang kind of thing. No, like this is the person who accuses us. This is the one who is an adversary to us. That's who he is.
Yeah, that helps to kind of correct what may be considered by some kind of a dualism.
Yeah.
You know, these dualistic, like Zoroastrianism, these dualistic religions where, you got God on one hand, you got Satan on the other hand, and like equal in power, and they're, you know, light and dark, all that. No, that's not the case at all. In fact, as we see from the narrative of Job, he can't do anything without God's approval. So, and I do like the fact that it's a title. I mean, it becomes a name later on, but the name is based upon the title itself, and the title is based upon what it means to satan someone. So when you satan someone, and that early in the biblical narrative, it can just mean to stand against somebody. So there are occasions when the messenger of the Lord satans someone. It just means that he stands in the way. He's an adversary to, in this case, like to Balaam, as he's going to address the Israelites. But most of the time, it's used in a negative sort of way, where the verb satan is an adversary, it's an accuser. So this is the guy who's the adversary. This is the accuser himself. He ends up there too, and the Lord begins to address him. It says, you know, where have you come from? And then Satan says, I've been going all over the place. I'm going to and from the earth, walking up and down. And I never can hear that verse without thinking of Peter. He says, the devil's a prowling lion. You know, lion's like going to and fro on the earth. He's walking up and down. He's looking for someone to devour. He's been checking things out. So the Lord says, have you considered my servant Job? And then we have God basically affirming, you know, in case there was any doubts, affirming the very things we've heard about from the opening verses, that there's none like him on the earth. He's blameless. He's upright. He fears God. He turns from evil. And you have this ongoing dialogue. And basically what the accuser says is, well, obviously he's like this because you have built a fence around him. The Hebrew there is kind of the idea of like a fence made of thorns or something, like a boma. You know, you get this fence made of all this thorny material. so that nothing can get to him. And as a result of this, well, yeah, Job is all has all the stuff that we've already heard about in those opening verses. And therefore, Satan says, take all that away. You know, burn down the hedge, take down the fence, and he's going to curse you to your face. So the only reason, so in other words, Job is the way he is because you've made life so easy for him. But take away all these sorts of things, and then you'll realize exactly what kind of person he is. And instead of blessing you, he's going to curse you to your face.
This is why I include in my daily prayer for God not to point me out to the devil. You know, now I don't think we had to worry about this. I don't know that. I doubt that God talks about us like this exactly, Chad. But just a good.
Have you considered my servant Daniel?
No, I don't need that.
Yeah. I don't. You don't want my piety to catch God's attention. Have you considered my servant? No, it's. I don't think anyone who knows us. I mean, like, I think you're pretty safe.
Yeah, <well.
laughs> you're gonna be good.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about this now, is that this is what it might feel like what Job was about to happen to Job, because obviously, God basically says, "I'll take you up on this challenge." Like, okay, so let's see if this is true. There are certainly times in your life where you feel that, I think maybe right now, God and the devil are against me. Like, I feel like I am, like, I have been, like, what, like, what's going on right now? Like, I have no friend with power, right? And God is just, at the very least, indifferent, you know, to what's going on here, if not complicit in it, you know? And you might feel that way. I mean, Job's got to have to feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. See, we know what's going on. He doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another very stark difference between our perception of this book and Job's perception of what's going on to him. So we're privy to all these details. He's not. Now, I used to think, well, if Job knew, it would make it better. I don't know that it would make it better. In fact, it maybe would make it worse. Maybe if Job were privy to all these terrible things that are happening to him, privy to the reason, he'd be like, well, I wish I didn't even know. And ignorance might not be bliss, but it's less painful than knowing under these circumstances.
I'm sure Job would be rolling out if he knew. I mean, if God was like, all right, listen, you're so good and so pious that I'm going to let the devil mess with you for a little while. I'm sure Job would be like, so the saying, no good deed goes unpunished, is exactly right. Like what's the point in being blameless if this is what you get? Like, so, like, yeah. I'm over here trying to walk upright, and I'm doing apparently a pretty good job of this, and nobody's doing it better than me, and this is what you get.
Yeah,
not a very good
the
incentive.
The whole tone of the book would. No, yeah, I think we still would have had a lot of speeches from Job, except the content would have been different. His laments would have taken on a different tone. But I mean, that's the kind of situation that we're at now. We'll see, of course, in verses 13 to following what happens. But it's a pretty good setup for what's coming next. We know who he is. We know what he's like. And we know what's happening on earth. And now we also know, at least initially, in this opening heavenly scene, what's happening up there. And as the story unfolds, we'll see more and more about, of course, what he loses and how Job responds to it. And as I read through the book, the transition that seems to take place for me is we move from a story about Job, the man, to a story about every man, so that Job takes on this kind of universal character, and we'll begin to see how we see ourselves in his struggles and how he responds. And then ultimately, the instruction that we have as the book gets toward the end and God begins to speak to him. So I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I know it's a dark book in many ways. It's a hard book, but I think it's extremely practical in the sense of it touches the core of what we all go through. Maybe we don't lose anything close to what Job lost, but we're all going to experience losses.
Yeah.
And sorrows in life. So it's going to be a great book to work our way through.
Awesome. All right, that is it. We will be back next week to see where the devil starts. It'll be a bummer, but you should come and join us to see where the devil starts and how Job responds. We'll check it out next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.